Recording?
Yeah, recording.
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 This is Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 28. Is that correct?
28, I think.
We're nearly correct if we're not correct.
I'm going to say 28.
We better check it.
Better check it?
Better
least
check it.
Professional podcast on internet still. Yep, episode 28.
Okay.
Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 28. And I am William, sometimes Hank.
I'm Rudy.
And I'm Mike.
Rudy doing his best impression of Mike doing an impression of, I don't know, a wildebeest or something.
Yes.
Okay, so today is our third Ronnie's podcast.
Yep.
We're going to be talking about the April round of the Ronnies, backed by popular demand, meaning one dude actually asked for it.
Yeah,
one dude.
I'm kind of amazed there's one dude listening to our podcast, let alone a dude listening and being like, hey, I like this, let's get some more
let's
of
get
this.
More,
yes,
right?
Like,
let's
no,
get more.
No, we're three jack-offs in Mom's basement. You don't want any more of this.
You don't want to test this.
No, you do want to test this because we'll fail.
Yeah.
Except we're succeeding right now because we're actually doing a podcast.
We are, I don't want to say winning. I will not say winning.
Winning!
God damn it!
Losers,
we're
winning.
We're fine up until somebody says, duh.
I don't know. I'm not following the Charlie Sheen thing. I'm trying not to follow
Charlie Sheen.
I will watch the movie when it eventually comes out.
Yeah, after he dies.
After he dies, and in which he'll almost certainly be played by Robert Downey Jr. I'm calling it now. It's gonna happen.
Yeah.
No, because Charlie doesn't even like Robert Downey Jr. now.
Yeah, but Robert Downey Jr. will take the role that will get him an Oscar after Charlie Sheen's fatal drug overdose. That's
going to
be laughter and tears, like, and 13 Golden Globes or whatever.
Ew. I'll be there.
You just call it losers winning.
Okay.
So, next.
It turns out that we have, we're going to be doing top five lists.
Yes.
As we have done for the past two rounds. It turns out that there's a lot more overlap between our lists than there has been, have been in the past. So first, let's have a little bit of a general discussion about this round of the Ronnies. First of all, the terms were...
choice.
They were choice.
Yes.
They were very choice. They were Lust, Chains, Amazon, and Queen.
Yes.
Yep.
These were perhaps the most emotionally loaded set of terms that we've seen thus far.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot you could do with it, but everybody was like, one track mind here, guys.
Yeah, there was a lot
much.
Of similarity here. Also some mechanical similarities. I mean, if round one was big, experimental, crazy mechanics, which it really was, you had card games, you had chess games, you had... you had Jeep Forum, you had all kinds of different dice mechanics in round one. And if round two was very strictly inspired by White Wolf games and Shadowrun, round one was the experimental round, and round two was the White Wolf round, this is very much the indie round.
Yes.
Because I feel like you got a lot of very... I don't know how else to say it, indie games, a lot of very compact games with very simple mechanics that were either lightweight mechanics or very thematic. And it was very much, it was very much what you would expect to find if you were browsing, like, you know, Independent Press Revolution or a collection of indie blogs.
Well, to put it simply, though, this is exactly why the site is called indie-rpg.com.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, The Forge is devoted to indie RPGs.
Yes.
But
I mean, this is This is like the moniker. They've earned it here.
Right, right. They've definitely, this is definitely more indie feeling. Mm. Because you see a lot of this idea of theme dominating content in these right. entries in a way that you didn't see, excuse me, in the last round or in the first round. In the first round, it was very much mechanics dominating theme. It was experiment, the experimental mechanics, the experimental gameplay dominating the narrative content or whatever you want to call it. In the second round, you saw a lot of dark gothic content yeah. with rather generic dice pull mechanics. Now, there were some very good games in round two, but that was, if you have to lump them all together, it's dark gothic plus dice pull.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas this one, you see very thematically focused games with usually very simple mechanics. So nothing that quite enters Norwegian territory or Jeep territory all the way, anyway.
Norwegian stuff.
That said, I think this may have been the strongest selection of games that we've seen yet for a Ronnie contest.
I'll agree with that. I didn't find a single bad game out of all of this.
Yeah,
even at the very least, even though the game mechanics were meh at best, the concept was awesome.
Yeah, I didn't find any that made me want to stop reading them, so...
Yeah, I think a lot of strong designs here. I was... That said, even though this was probably the strongest set of games, they were also, I have to admit, in some way, paradoxically, the most disappointing set of games, given the terms.
Yeah.
I feel like the games were a little timid, considering that you have big loaded terms like lust
right.
and chains
yeah.
and even Amazon and Queen. I mean,
yeah.
First of all, we didn't get any truly straight up erotic games.
No.
There were no games that existed primarily to arouse or titillate. And in fact, the game that is on it is that superficially the most sexualized game, Cam Horrors, is probably the least erotic game of the set.
Yeah.
Yes.
In a lot of ways.
I can totally tell you, yeah.
In that it's really... I can't imagine playing a session of Cam Horrors with someone and being like, yeah, I'm so aroused right now.
Yeah.
Because it's really a depressing, demoralizing kind of game.
Yeah.
But I... And a very good one, and we're going to get to it, I'm
yeah.
sure, when we do our top five list. But I was kind of disappointed that no one just flat out said, I'm going to do an erotic fantasy game, and let's push this all the way.
Yeah.
Although I have to ask a question on this. If there was an erotic game, was this something that Ron would have looked at positively?
See, I don't know. I mean, he did create that list of terms. I mean,
right.
I'm thinking he probably wanted some, at least a couple erotic games in there.
And you have games that are kind of tilting at being erotic, kind of like in the way that, you know, Luis Vallejo painting is erotic, in that meaning not erotic at all, you know? Where it's this kind of sterilized, exaggerated kind of fantasy sexuality that... You know, unless you're a particular, like I said, it's sterilized, very clinical, very by-the-numbers kind of sexuality at play here that I can't imagine, very safe.
Yeah.
You know, not a game that people would actually play as an erotic game, but play like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're playing an erotic game, you know? Like you could imagine it, the illustrations being those, what was the name of the guy who, Phil Foglio, who did all the ridiculous caricatures, you know, the women with the giant breasts, you know.
And he still does that, may I add.
Right. Because
he does a comic now.
Right, and there was nothing sexy at all about it, because it was that kind of exaggerated kind of sexuality. And you can kind of see that in some of these games. Like for example, Queens of Time and Space, you kind of get that
yes.
kind of vibe from.
Yeah.
Also, Homage to Ninjabur has that kind of vibe. Also, though, even setting the most obvious applications of lust aside, you don't get into the more demanding, more emotionally, socially, politically charged meaning of terms like chains. I mean, slavery, for example. Once again, Homage to Ninjabur gets at slavery, but it gets at this kind of fantasy slavery, you know, where the slaves have magic powers.
Yes.
But you don't get at the really nasty, demoralizing awfulness of slavery.
Right.
And you don't get at any of the real sociological dimensions to slavery. And also, chains and lust, I mean, you could finally have a game that dealt with
sexual slavery
in a way that's different from the kind of sexual slavery that you see once again in Ninjabur, where it's like the slaves are kind of manipulating their masters. You could have a really hardcore, serious, disturbing game about sex trafficking.
Yeah.
You could. Or you could have a game about the relationships between masters and slaves on a plantation, which is nothing like the sort of erotic, manipulative kind of sexuality in Homage to Ninjabur. You also don't get at it. Nothing really got at the economic dimensions of terms like slaves or queen.
Yeah, I don't think you were going to get that anyway, at least as far as Queen. But there was at least as far as this point is concerned, there must have been at least one or two people that said, oh yeah, that's so obviously sexual, I'm going to try and stay away from that as much as possible.
I think that everyone said that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, now I'm going to make it ironically sexual.
Mm. Right.
And that's fine. And there were some people who did that in a really... who were really effective in doing that. But I do wish that more people had, you know, gone for the jugular with these terms. Really just taken all the nasty, controversial, ugly ramification of these terms and made them into games.
Yeah.
With that said, Rudy, you and I both came up with some ideas that ultimately didn't get fleshed out into games.
Yeah, we did.
I don't know if Mike, did you have any ideas for this round?
No, I didn't even know about the round until after it was done.
That's right.
Because I don't hang out at the forums in any way whatsoever.
And you've been busy on your WoW server trying to get it.
Yes.
Running.
Well, no, not my WoW server. Do not sue me.
Yes, no, it's not Mike's WoW server.
I was about to say, shh, that's illegal. Under the table stuff.
Seriously, guys, not mine, literally.
Right. No, Mike is in no way affiliated with this WoW server we just mentioned.
Yes, I don't even know the name of the guy running it.
Okay, so one listener. Shh. Okay, yes, but that's one of the reasons why we've been on hiatus.
Yeah.
People have been busy, so that's why we skipped a couple of weeks.
Yes.
So, Rudy, what were some of the games that you came up with for this round of the Rise?
Well, I was gonna use Chains and Lust to make a game about the Syracuse Dungeon Master guy who kept women as slaves, sexual slaves.
Runaways, primarily.
Yeah, primarily runaways as sexual slaves in his dungeon that he built in his backyard. Yep.
Yeah. It was a dungeon. Let's just.
It was a dungeon.
Straight.
Yeah.
That's not a D&D metaphor.
It was an actual
dude
dungeon.
Dude built a concrete dungeon
concrete
in his backyard.
Yes, yep. We're talking about, you know, kidnapping people and then, you know... something you would see on Criminal Minds.
right, exactly.
Yeah, or even, like, Law and Order of Special Victims.
Right.
Yeah. And that never got anywhere. And, Then I was going to make a game basically about the... basically about anthropologists in the Amazon molesting young girls from an uncontacted tribe.
Based on the documentary Secrets of the Tribe.
Yeah.
So basically how anthropologists exploit indigenous populations, newly discovered indigenous populations. Yeah.
And those were my ideas. So what were some of yours?
Well, you had another idea.
Oh, yeah, this one may be too hot for TV, though.
No, there's no way it's too hot for TV.
This is the internet. There's nothing too hot about it until you get arrested.
Well, it's too hot for Mom's Basement Podcast.
That's true.
And just a second, you just suggested a game where you play as a man who abducts runaways and molests them in a dungeon in his backyard.
Yes.
So I don't think this is quite on that level.
Well, basically, it was about... FBI investigators in the year 20 billion something investigating or going after some pedophile who had set himself up in some little black hole pocket dimension or something. He had set himself up with using technology as some kind of fantasy wizard and he abducted a child and he was in there molesting him, and the FBI investigators had to disguise themselves as orcs to get the child back. It was going to be called Black Riders, but...
And,
yeah, there's nothing redeeming about that one, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, no.
But, very similar to a Vladimir Nabokov book, actually, The Enchanter.
The Enchanter, yeah.
That's true.
Except that didn't have the sci-fi dimensions to it.
That part's not even important.
Actually, that wasn't the game I was suggesting. You had yet another idea. You really ran away with ideas.
What was the other
content. You had.
Oh, that's right. Operation Desert Storm.
Yes.
Which was a game that was about lesbian Marines in Iraq.
And this would have been a real erotic game.
This would have been an erotic game. And the mechanics basically involved making other people get an erection at the table.
So you would frame titillating situations, scenarios, and you would play through them in an increasingly suggestive way until someone at the table had to admit, I just got aroused.
Yeah, they got wood at the table.
And then it would transition quickly to a combat scene
in
order to suppress the wood.
Yep.
Mike struggling to make it through this one.
I'm done. I'm laughing on that one. That's great.
You could translate into another titillating, you know, bunk scene, whatever. I told you that would probably be about 3 pages, and that you should have written it up and submitted
it
just to get Ron Edwards' critique.
I would absolutely agree with that. That's trolling 101, baby.
I had only one idea for this Ronnie World competition.
But it was choice.
Kind of, I guess.
Well, not choice enough that it was made.
Not choice enough to be made. Not choice enough to get me off my ass. Although I guess that's not even accurate, since I would have been on my ass on the computer. Not choice enough to open up Microsoft Word and stop watching repeats of Fringe on Hulu.
Oh, poor Fringe.
This game would have been called Welfare Queens. And it's a cyberpunk game set in the not-too-distant future where rich corporate executives, white-collar business people, who are burdened by the chains of their work and life, and by the way, this would have been chains and queens if you hadn't already guessed, the burdens of day-to-day life as a millionaire, would on their weekends enter virtual reality simulations where they were poor welfare mothers living in the projects.
Welfare queens.
Living on public assistance. Yeah. And it was supposed to be kind of a satire on the big burst in popularity of Randian ideas and the Tea Party movement. And also on, as I call them, feel bad to feel good movies like Precious and Precious.
Yes.
Precious.
There aren't many of them.
Well, there's a whole
genre of
ghetto cinema that's all about white people feeling good about themselves while they watch bad black people in bad economic situations lift themselves up by their bootstraps.
Well, it's basically blaxploitation.
Right.
Yes, that's
well,
exactly
what I was going to say. Blaxploitation that wins Sundance Awards
right.
and shit.
Well, it's blaxploitation without the redeeming qualities of blaxploitation.
Right.
Because in blaxploitation, usually there's at least a white bad guy
exactly.
who's rich and responsible yeah. for everything. And shit gets resolved when that guy gets a bullet in his head or gets
yep.
arrested or whatever, gets taken down by Shaft.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas these movies have no white people whatsoever. The ghetto is a what's the word I'm looking for? Not homogenous, hermetically sealed environment, which is totally responsible for its own poor situation.
Yeah.
And everyone in it is totally capable to just pull themselves up the economic ladder once
yeah.
they get enlightened and leave their getaways behind.
Yeah.
Oh, once they stop getting nappy froze.
Right.
Yeah.
And so yeah, this would have used the escapist rules, the escapist rule set, which I will eventually put on paper, put in some kind of published form, hopefully.
Oh.
But that would have been Welfare Queens.
Nigger, 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 nigger.
Was that for Dan Marusak?
Yes, it was. Dan, if you're listening, I love you.
clearly we do this week, though, but we'll get
yeah,
to
we
that
do.
Later.
Yes.
Oh, we definitely do it.
Rudy, should we...
Nah, don't even worry about it.
Don't even worry about
yeah.
it?
Nah.
Okay.
No point in it.
Because I'm trying to think whether... What would be more racist, to leave that unaddressed or to be like, oh yeah, Rudy can say that, he's the black one.
it's actually better to say that he's the black one. Because think about what Kobe Bryant just did with the word faggot.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
The fact that he addressed it made it more anti-gay.
Yeah. So, draw your own conclusions, fans,
yeah.
Mom's Basement Podcast, about that.
Yep.
So, moving on, back to Ronnie's.
Yep.
So, usually before we do our top five list, we have some honorable mentions.
Yep.
And one thing I have been doing in the past is pointing out games that had cool flavor, but for whatever reason, the mechanics weren't really there to make the list. In the first round, it was War of the Sheaves, which actually did make my list at number 5, which had a really awesome bit of con-worlding, a little awesome bit of setting development, but rather generic mechanics. In the second round, it was Sky Patrol, which was basically the same thing. It was really fantastically awesome World War One era steampunk setting.
Oh, what's it called? Air Patrol.
Air
right?
Patrol, yeah.
Yeah, yep.
But rather generic RPG mechanics.
Right. Yeah.
This time there are actually two games that I thought were really cool from a flavor perspective, but kind of mechanically lacking for whatever reason. The first one is Tales of Lust, which I thought...
Gracie
the dog providing background noise.
But they probably can't hear that.
No, probably not. Okay, Tales of Lust, which has this awesome setup about basically fairy tale creatures that are controlled by, first of all, the story being told about them, but also the psychological desires and lusts underlying that story.
Right.
Which is unfortunately burdened by mechanics that were, and this will probably be the first and last time you will ever hear me say this, but too simple, actually, I felt. Not robust enough to support the awesome thematic weight of the game. Because it basically turned these struggles with lust, the way these monsters were struggling with their internal desires, their lusts, into simple Goal of D6, resolve the challenge situations. Mm-hmm. That felt, first of all, very much like simple task resolution as opposed to this kind of the epic battle with yourself that it should be.
Right.
Yeah.
And also just simply too lightweight for the weight of the material. And once again, this is coming from the ultra-lightweight mechanics man.
Yeah, I gotta back you up on that one. This seemed like the sort of game that the Brothers Grimm would absolutely love.
Yes.
Yeah. But there just wasn't enough there that they would actually get behind it. There needs to be something there more that made it feel like your inner hatred and lust and desires were actually being filled out in
right.
some way.
Made it more emotionally dynamic when yes. you get to those moments of challenge. And the fact that the role that resolves the ultimate moment of climax of whether you give in to your loss or are able to fend them off is the same type of simple die roll that has been resolving everything up to that point feels very anticlimactic.
Yeah.
But I love the thematic material of this. It reminded me very much of, I don't know if either of you have seen...
Like
yep. Performance of Sondheim's Into the Woods, the musical, which is all about fairy tales and stuff. But it includes a segment with the Big Bad Wolf. And the Big Bad Wolf's costume has this giant dangling synthetic penis on it. And it really just summed up everything that the Big Bad Wolf is about, which is this kind of this image of unrestrained, crazy desires, you know, lusts that are bursting out of this person. If you think about that story, and a lot of these fairy tales, it's always about an adolescent character. They go into the woods, or they go into some foreign area, they are tempted, and they give in to the temptations to the degree and pay a terrible cost for it. And so there really is a lot of that... moment of sexual discovery, moment of sexual change underlying all these stories, that discovery of lust. And I like the fact that Tales of Lust really got at that thematic material, but wasn't digging the mechanics.
Yeah, I mean, this game seemed to scream out Rumpelstiltskin right in my mind.
Yes,
what is
yeah.
I read it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if that quite fits the adolescent theme you were going for there on that description, but everything else, like Hansel and Gretel, that sort of shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Hansel and Gretel is another really good example. The other game that falls into this category, awesome flavor, mechanical issues, was Her Son.
Which, I was going to mention that one.
Good. Well, what were you going to say about it?
I was going to say it's got a real powerful theme to it, you know, with cancer and that kind of deal. But it seemed like it was kind of a clusterfuck of ideas.
Yeah. and kind of half finished. Because there are moments in the text where the author, and I'm going to look for his name. Jackson Tegu?
Yep.
Essentially says, I'm going to add this later, you know, or I still need to think about this mechanic, which comes up when you have 24-hour RPGs. But I don't feel like the mechanics there were finished enough for the game to actually be totally playable. And the fact that so much of it was also written in a narrative voice only kind of added confusion to that.
Yeah, I thought the narrative voice was okay, but I got kind of uneasy when I read the very first sentence in this. It was something about black kings and how they're your father and they left you as a
That was awesome.
That was great. That was great. And I think that I'm definitely not saying, no, throw out the narrative voice, get rid of it. What I'm saying is he needs to firm up the way the narrative voice presents the rules in his game so that they're clearer. The narrative voice is awesome and really gets at what this game is all about.
Right.
And that Black King line was fucking awesome.
Awesome. I liked it too a lot. It was just like, huh?
Yeah, that was
yeah,
coming
off.
Didn't see that coming.
It really grabs you. It almost in the way that good short stories or literature will grab you with the first line and make you say, what? Yeah.
And to bring a point up, this is almost like the Precious thing right there. Because you have this point where you have this downtrodden woman, and you got the kid who's living in kind of shitty conditions, and he's trying to lift himself out of this shithole by fantasizing about saving her.
Right, which is something that happened in the movie Precious a lot. It's also strong parallels to Pan's Labyrinth.
Yes. Yeah, I did not see all of that movie, but I'm familiar.
Hatred come down.
So, other people who have honorable mentions or special categories.
Mine was Beholden.
Yes.
Baxel and Ben Lehman. Not so much a fan of the solo RPG. I don't know if I mentioned that before. But this is like the greatest psychological thought experiment that people really need to go through. This is like coming of age sort of thing, I kind of feel. If you're between the ages of 14 and 18, please do this.
It's a pretty awesome thought experiment, and I'm glad you used that terminology, because that's exactly what it is. And this game was so close to being on my list, and it was so close to taking that number 5 spot, and the only thing that held it off of that spot was my own ignorance of Ben Lehman's game, Beloved. I think that's the name of the game.
Yes,
that's it. And I didn't know how strong the relationship was between Beholden and Beloved. And I didn't feel like I could adequately critique Baxel's work without playing, or at least reading, Ben Lehman's original. Because if too much of it was taken, you know, in its entirety and not modified enough, I might say, well, there's not enough of Baxel's original work in here to make this a really good he calls it a recontextualization or a pastiche of Ben Lehman's game. But really, without seeing Ben Lehman's game first, I couldn't pass strong judgment on Beholden. But taking Beholden totally alone, I think is just a fantastic thought experiment. And I think it really gets at that the psychological state of feeling like you're being, feeling insignificant and tested towards some purpose and feeling ambivalent about whether or not the thing you're pursuing is real, is valuable, and is attainable, most of all.
Right.
And I think that's something that a lot of people go through in life. And being able to frame it as this sort of personal identity myth, really, myth in the classical sense, is I think, really cool. And like you said, maybe actually psychologically beneficial.
Well, there's a second whole layer to this, in that whether what you're after is valuable, but you also have the part about how far are you willing to go to make the person fight for what he thinks is valuable,
whether or not it's actually valuable.
And that, even though it becomes repetitive, it's like, yeah, okay, there's something there.
So yeah, totally digging Beholden. And to get at the solo RPG issue that you mentioned, I'm not a big fan of solo RPGs, because often, and I mentioned this, in the first round or the second round? I think it was the first round, but sometimes solo RPGs really feel like homework because they have a big writing, journal keeping component or whatever, and without the social experience of role playing, you kind of start to think, well, is this busy work? This doesn't have any of that busy work in it. It's totally internal role playing, or almost totally internal, which is really cool.
And what isn't internal is you drawing picture of what you're thinking of, giving it actual form to make the psychological experiment go further, since you have
something to anchor it to.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So Rudy, runners up, honorable mention.
I don't really have any besides those three.
Special thoughts? Okay then. I think we can move on to our list. I just wanted to say one thing about one game that I don't think made anyone's list. Mm. In Exile should be the Super Mario Brothers RPG.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it should. Yeah, you had the letters from the princess.
The letters from the princess that occur periodically to keep stringing you along. And the queen, but could easily be princess, who's chained up somewhere in exile, and you don't get to her until the end.
Yeah.
Right.
No, that was definitely Super Mario.
Someone needs to do a hack of In Exile to turn it into the Super Mario Brothers RPG. Okay, so our lists.
Yep.
You want to start us off, Booty, with your number five?
My number five was The Shackled Self.
Yes.
Ooh-wah.
Ooh-wah, indeed. Ooh-wah.
This game just blew me away.
Yeah, it...
first of all, this game has a board. So, that...
And unless you know Booty, you can't understand just how important that is.
Yeah, well, that got me hard right away. I was already looking at the game... You know, with a kind of, I was kind of hard to it before, but the fact that it had a board just made me go crazy, because I think that board really kind of congealed the whole experience of it. Like, first of all, the way the player roles are set up is brilliant.
Yes.
I thought, because.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Basically, you have the temptation, which I think is a really awesome, awesome role.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that it says that you have to be, or that you should be attracted to that person.
And you know that?
It should be someone you find physically or however romantically attractive.
And this is the ironic thing. We said earlier that there weren't any truly erotic games.
Right.
This comes the closest to being
an erotic game.
Yes.
In that it gets at the real tangible physical and psychological emotions that surround lust and that surround these kinds of human relationships.
It's almost like a journey of lust.
Right, almost.
Yeah, almost like a...
And you're trying yourself, but... Literally yourself first, because you're trying not to sabotage your character for the person that you have a crush on or whatever, maybe the case. And then you've got the, I forgot what I was going to say. Great. But yeah.
But yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I'm not going to talk about this too much right now because, spoiler alert, it appears... On my list.
It also appears on my list.
It appears significantly higher on my list. So I will talk about it later.
I think the board setup really augmented the game pretty well. Mm-hmm. And it didn't feel like... I mean, when you have a board in a role-playing game, you really have to, I think, try to make it so that it doesn't feel like it's... kind of like detached from the game.
Yes.
And this one definitely didn't feel at all like it was detached from the game.
Right.
Because it basically controlled scene framing and all of that stuff. So.
Right. Yeah, the relationship between the board game and the RPG has to be very carefully calibrated.
Yeah.
Because or else you can have two completely foreign experiences. One that's a board game. It's like, okay, let's sit down and move the pieces on the board. Okay, now let's get up and roleplay.
Right.
This game doesn't feel like that at all. And I think it's because, in part, because the person who has control over the piece itself, the movement itself, fluctuates based on what happened in the scene.
Game,
And also simply because movement on the board is so fast.
Right.
So the transition between board and scene is almost seamless.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's just great. But like I said, more on that later.
Oh, yes. Also, he mentioned rules for food, which I thought was awesome.
Yes, that's right. I love that.
Yes, I want to address that later.
Unsalted rice or other food that's not too spicy, I guess.
Matzah.
Yeah, matzah. Yeah, no, I just love this game all around.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought the player roles were so so different
mm-hmm.
that you can really have so much replay value yes. to this game.
Yeah. And yeah. so much of it is controlled by the questionnaire character
right.
creation that you can have entirely different games.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is rare in for games that have three distinct, structured, specific roles to them.
Right, yep.
Yeah. Maintaining strong replay value in those kinds of games is very
difficult.
Yeah. You did a very good job there.
So let me ask you this, Woody. Why is it only at number 5, then?
Basically because I had a bunch of other games that really... There was a superhero game this time.
yes. That yeah. would do it. And that would...
That definitely... Yep.
Okay.
Mr.
Mike, you're number 5.
My number 5. Cam Whores. I put this up there simply because... Two reasons. First... It seemed like the author had a little bit of experience with people that did this. Now, I'm not saying that she did this. Yeah. I'm saying she knew people that did this. Yeah.
Apparently, Van Lehman is the quote in her the awesome quote in her manual, is to be believed.
Yeah.
So, there's that. And then there's the Amazon wish list. The most inventive use of the word Amazon in this.
Yeah.
This game had, far and away, the best use of terms of any game.
Yes.
So far.
Yep.
Easily.
I would argue that too.
This was amazing. I mean, it didn't make top of my list because it seemed one track topic-y. So you're going to have... The marks are very similar because they're all sleazy assholes.
So you felt like there wasn't enough flexibility in this game to give it a lot of replay value.
Right. But the few sessions you could get out of this seemed really fun.
This is on my list again. Like I said before, a lot of overlap in our list this time.
Yes.
Like the Shackled Self, this is much higher on my list. So I will discuss it when the time comes.
Yeah, it's also much higher on Rudy's list, I think.
Yep, it's number 1. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Put your tags up, dude.
Yeah.
Okay, so how about you, Hank?
My number 5 was The Strongest Link.
Hmm.
This was a game that made it by sheer Machiavellian, hard-on-inducing awesomeness alone.
Yeah, it was pretty Machiavellian.
This is a game that, I don't know, I really like games that try to get at group dynamics and group politics.
Mm.
And not just the dynamics of fictional groups or hypothetical groups like politicians or spaceship captains, but the dynamics of the group that you're playing in itself.
Mm.
And I think this game does it elegantly and cautiously. Because it's something that you have to be very careful about, because if you don't at least frame it in terms of a hypothetical, in terms of a fictional scenario, you have the potential to get some group nastiness developing.
Yeah.
But I think this is a situation where that hypothetical is such a thin veneer on the actual freewheeling dynamics going on that you start off with the pretense of, oh, we're... the example he gives is spaceship captains, I think, arguing over... whatever's going on the spaceship, I guess.
Yeah.
So you operate under the pretense that, okay, we're warring spaceship captains trying to diplomatically solve this conflict.
Yeah.
But once the play actually develops, it quickly becomes a group manipulating each other on a personal level.
Right.
And I think the rules that he has are very elegant. None of them seem like rules that exist just to be RPG rules.
Right.
I could almost see this game being played as a corporate team building event.
Yes, exactly.
At a retreat or something. And I don't mean that as an insult. But I could absolutely see it being played as that way. Because it's really a chance... And there's even that moment at the end of the game where you're supposed to sit back and reflect on what the dynamics of what just happened. And that, I think, was great. Because I've never seen an RPG that does that in the way this game does. Hmm. The reason it didn't get higher on my list is, first of all, it had really stiff competition. There were three games this time that I thought were just absolute masterpieces. Maybe that's pushing it a little hard, but that I thought were really brilliant designs. And one, a fourth game that it was just really, really good. So there wasn't much room on the list for this to creep up. Maybe this would have been higher on the list if this was the first or second round. Also, though, I feel it was held back primarily by a lack of really fleshing out the possibilities that the rules that are created by the rules. Not adding more rules, not adding more mechanical bulk to it, but simply adding more examples that explain the different directions that you could take the rule set that he has, and really fleshing it out, with examples, putting it in the context. I would have liked to see one single fictional example that was used to frame an entire, you know, hypothetical play session.
Right, yeah, that's true.
Because I feel like you would have gotten a better sense of the dynamics, of what exactly, what specifically happens in one of these games.
Especially as far as what happens during the role-playing part.
Right.
Because it didn't seem like there was a lot of instruction as far as how you were supposed to role-play.
How are you supposed to wheel and deal?
Yeah.
I like the fact that he made it clear, though, that the wheeling and dealing has to take place at least under the pretense of being in character.
Being in character,
so there's no out-of-character begging for tokens.
Right, yeah.
Right.
So that was the strongest link. Rudy, you're number four.
Number four was Within My Clutches, which is a David Berg superhero game, a supervillain's lament. This is a superhero game, so automatically it gets two full hard-ons from me. But this is also a superhero game with a very well-written step-by-step manual.
Yes.
And that was something that, because I looked at the manual for Capes, and I was like, nah, I can't figure this shit out. and I thought at first when I saw, I had scrolled all the way to the back, to the chart when I first looked at the game. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was gonna be like Capes.
Right.
But as I read it, I found out that no, it's actually got pretty fairly straightforward, simple mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
But they're robust enough to do what he wanted to do, which is basically
get into the neuroses of supervillain.
Exactly.
Which is what really elevates this game.
Yeah.
By the way, this game was created by David Berg, whose game Memory Quest was almost on our list in round two, and kind of just barely managed to slip off the bottom of everyone's list. So I feel like he kind of got locked out.
Yeah.
But his game, The Eye and the Pyramid, made your list in round one.
I loved that game.
And the Within My Clutches not only makes your list, but it's going to be on my list as well, eventually. So, I think of the three games he designed, this is far and away the standout one.
Yeah,
I mean, he's I'll give him this much. He's very consistent on how well he performs.
Yes. And he's very consistent in terms of getting at games, at developing games that get at hidden underlying emotions, hidden purposes, hidden motives, I guess you could say. Yeah, all of his games are somehow about hidden motives. He loves mindfuck games, and he does them quite well.
Yes. I did not hate this game either. This, even though it didn't make my list, still a good game.
What I think elevates this game above his other mindfuck games is the way this game's personal.
Yeah.
The Eye in the Pyramid and Memory Quest. I mean, Memory Quest was about the struggle of one particular individual, but it didn't really get at the personal motivations and behaviors of the characters involved to the level that Within My Clutches does.
Just the way he breaks down the superhero or the supervillain into you know, their wants.
Right.
Their respect, adoration, self-actualization. Seriously.
Yes.
I mean, that's just pretty awesome.
And breaks down in multiple meanings of
yeah.
the term. I mean, breaks down in terms of deconstructing, taking it apart, and seeing what makes these supervillains tick. But also in developing a game that breaks them down as you
exactly.
run the game.
And further, and he makes mention of this at the end of the game, at the notes on genre. But he says this game can actually be used to play more than just superheroes, supervillains.
Yeah.
You could, one thing that I saw in there is he said soul-crushing office mundanity.
Yeah.
And I think this would be perfect for an office sim or some kind
or,
of...
Or the office RPG.
The office RPG, exactly, yeah.
So true.
Yeah, because it's all about... It's all about being, I don't know, being there but not being there. You know, being
right.
having it within your grasp, but nah, you're not going to
right.
get it.
And chasing something that the simple structure of life
exactly.
and society just prevents
it's just set up
from,
to deny it.
Right, right, which
yeah.
is very much corporate life.
Exactly. But no, that's within my clutches. So big hard-on for superhero.
I'd like to mention one thing, but I have to check the manual since it's been a while since I've looked at this one. Where is that? I'm looking for something specific.
And
my bad.
For our listeners, I think this is going to be a slightly extended episode.
Yes.
Because we're at 50 minutes right now, so we're probably going to have about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
They break at an hour and a half.
Oh, never mind. I think of the wrong thing, but still, this is really good.
Yeah, it's a pretty epic game.
Yes. Mike, what is your number four?
You Are My Destiny. Which is actually kind of surprising, but this was a good game, but it feels like, oddly, this is the sort of game that I kind of imagine... It's like the prototypical teen superhero drama
yes.
game.
Yes.
There's so many stereotypes waiting to be played, and it just asks for everyone to play stereotypes since it's very emotional at its base. And it asks you to get at the... Because emotion is the base of the power in this game.
Right.
And it's just got so much to it.
There is a lot to it.
There was a lot.
And that... Almost to a point where it's kind of detrimental, I felt. Because this was a game that really had me strongly initially. I loved the setup. I loved the idea that the desire you're pursuing is both your goal and the thing that might trip you up, that might undermine your goal. And simply this idea of a game where it's not... Your powers aren't... They're internal... But they aren't truly internal because they're manifesting themselves because of your obsession
right.
with this other object, this other individual.
Right.
And I just loved it conceptually. But I felt like the rules were presented in a way that was kind of obfuscating, was kind of opaque, difficult to unravel. And also, I wasn't totally... This was another game where a lot of important... resolution comes down to simple D6 die rolls, which is not something mechanically that I really dig.
Yeah, I'm okay with that because it kind of messed with your character.
Yeah.
At the most inopportune times, you can make a fail roll, and then suddenly you have to be on your toes how you role play it out.
Right.
That's true.
And the end, if I remember this right, hopefully I get this right, the end scene where the object you're after could absolutely reject you was masterful.
Yeah, so that was.
Because just when you think the game, you instead get to play a super depressed motherfucker. And it's just, that was so awesome.
That's true. And there were several games in this round that had really good end game mechanics. And, Shackled Self had that.
Yes.
And we'll get to that, I'm sure, when it comes up again. My number four, Brick and Mortar. This game, I was really impressed with the way roles work in this game. Also, there's in addition to my awesome flavor, but if he rules execution reward. Every single round has had my award for game that's most like a game I've already made.
Yeah.
In the first round, it was Skull Full of Bong Hits, which was strikingly like my game Escape is. In the second round, it was They Became Flesh, which had a moral currency mechanic, which was very similar to something I was working on for an Old Testament game. In this case, we have a game about people who are trapped, where you have several characters trapped, isolated within a very confined space, who are assigned very distinct roles, with those roles having a very clear impact on play. And I have a game in development called, the development name is Isolation, which is about those movies where you have four or five people, you know, who wake up trapped in a box or in a small enclosed space with a ticking doomsday timer or some kind of deadly time-bound scenario, and where at least one of them is a traitor and there's all this duplicity. And that game also had people stuck in a confined space with very specific roles that they had to play. So any game that's like, hey, I made a game like that, automatically gets ego appeal. In addition to that, though, I really like how he executed the roles. And this is something that wasn't in my game, using what basically breaks down to ritualized language.
Yeah.
Where you have specific catchphrases that characters say, and they have mechanical weight. And each role has a list of catchphrases with the mechanical relevance of each catchphrase. So this is a catchphrase, this is what it does in play. If you say this, this is how it changes the scenario. Mm. And I thought, not only was that just really cool from a mechanical standpoint, but it fits so perfectly with the idea of these generic horror movie, with generic horror movies, where people say specific things like, oh no, what was that?
Yeah.
You know, and it means something. It's highly ritualized language, where these common phrases have special meanings within the form, within the media that they exist in.
Right.
And I think he really nailed that.
Yeah, he definitely did.
And I like the metaphorical level that this works at, where the struggle against the aliens or the blobs or the zombies is really about the small retailer
struggling against the brick and mortar store.
Yeah, struggling against Amazon and the chain stores.
Yep.
And I think that's very fantastic, not just because it's cool within the context of the game, but once again, it really links up to the movies that he's basing these games on.
Hmm.
Because, like, Romero's movies were not just zombies show up. Ah,
right.
It was always zombies make a social statement.
Right.
Yes.
And so once again, he's using that kind of scenario to make a pretty clear social statement. The reasons that this game didn't make it higher, though, are linked to that. I think he could have made that metaphor a little stronger. I think he could have done more to flesh it out and build more parallels between the fate of the brick and mortar, you know, mom and dad, hobby shop or whatever, independent retailer, and the zombie apocalypse or the alien invasion. I also think he could have done more to tie this game to the terms provided. He picked chains and Amazon. Mm. And Amazon in particular, I felt the link was pretty weak. In the setup, he mentions that, well, Amazon is one of the major threats to these small mom-and-pop stores.
Yeah.
But then it never developed beyond that. There's no real sense of... I would have liked maybe a mechanic that tied... being able to purchase things off Amazon to maybe one of the stocking mechanics in the game, the inventory mechanics in the game. Mm-hmm. Or just somehow to really get that term in there and a little bit stronger. And once again, chains. The chain stores are, once again, they're the threat.
Right.
But really, if you could have integrated the sense of that threat more into the meaning of that threat, or more content or context for that threat into the game itself, because
right.
it feels like all of that kind of disappears after the game's set up.
Right.
So, Uri, number three.
Well, my number three was Brick and Mortar.
Okay.
So I'm not going to say too much about this one since you already hit on it pretty good.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about more of it later, probably.
Yeah. But I like the way this splits. It splits the roles into before play, when play begins, during play. It's,
yeah.
Mechanically, it really tells you how to play the game really well.
Right, right.
It really tells you, and... I know some games I've seen that have roles kind of get that muddled, and it's kind of difficult to tell, like, what you do while you're playing the game.
Right, and what you do before the game, and what you're doing, and what the parts of the role are just there for flavor.
Just there for flavor, exactly.
Yeah.
That's yeah. And I get the way he laid this out, this is a very clean document.
It is,
really.
It is.
Clear layout, and it looks like it's really kind of plug and play, like easy
right.
to pick up.
Right.
And hey, and that looks like the style of game it is something
right.
that can be picked up and played really quickly. But, trying to think what else. I just generally like the way it's set up so that whenever certain cues that happen in the role playing. Occur, something happens.
They trigger
your
catchphrases.
Oh, your catchphrases. I mean, that just made so much sense to me. And, it's basically... Oh, yeah, and also it has a hipster, so...
Yeah.
Hey. Hipster is one of the roles.
Yeah, the play here is very fluid.
It is.
And, which is something that I feel is very different than Dan Muruschak's other game that we played, Final Hour of the Storied Age, which was very structured in
right.
discrete, distinct phases. Here, the game is very streamlined, very fluid, where things within play will trigger other things within play automatically without the need to switch gears, switch phases.
Yeah.
One small niggling thing, I'm not sure how I feel about the fact that, once again, one D6 die roll can have made huge consequences, like killing
characters
consequences. Or deciding whether or not your character escapes the scene consequences.
That's true.
And that also could potentially lead to situations where someone is killed or escapes early in the game and then is sitting on the sidelines. So,
Although what he does to sort of mitigate that is he has the plus ones,
yes,
the tokens you
yes.
can stick on your cards.
That's true.
Which
but
also,
definitely a plus.
Yeah. But also he sort of makes it so that it's all situational, too. The dice rolls are largely situational, so...
Right.
I guess the way...
That's true.
I don't know.
No, I mean, absolutely. He definitely does some things to mitigate that, and
yeah.
I think you're right there.
It's actually a pretty complex game. When I saw the D6s, too, I was like,
that looks kind of simplistic.
But it's
mechanically robust, and like you said, he does include... mechanical factors in the form of the tokens that you can cash out to boost your die roll to prevent it being simple roll you live,
roll
you die.
Exactly,
yeah.
But I really like that game. So, Mike, what about your
number? Your number three.
My number three, Queen of Thorns
by Eric Boyd.
This got me for the main reason that it seemed like it was something that had an artificial timeline, like you felt like you had a sense of urgency in this game.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what really attracted it to me in the first place.
Because
that's the sort of thing that you could play this probably in 2 to 4 hours, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And it kept you focused on what you needed to do instead of constantly getting sidetracked.
Right.
And I think that has some nice consequences in gameplay.
Right.
In this sort of setting with this high fantasy or epic fantasy or whatever you choose to with this setup.
Right.
With the Queen of Thorns holding your desire hostage, more or less. And also with the threat of the Queen of Thorns ready to rape your fucking ass.
Yeah.
Do not alert the Queen of Thorns. However, what also helps is that you can mitigate that within the dice roll system that it has through the fudge dice, which are... I haven't really heard of these dice before, but apparently I guess they're not used too often, so... Mm. But it's a nice use of it in this case, since it keeps things very simple, I think. Mm. You just have pluses and minuses and blank spaces. That's all you got to really do, and successes and failures. More than each number means something different, or total it up and then see if you win or fail or, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different.
And I think this game comes up again. Not on my list.
Comes up on mine.
On Rudy's list. So, Rudy, you can talk about it when it comes up on your list, yeah, for the sake of time. Okay, were you done, Mike?
Yes.
Okay, my number three game, Within My Clutches. We already talked about it.
Within
I just want to underscore it, the things that I loved about it, and the one thing that I was a little bit iffy on. What I loved about Within My Clutches, the concept. Hmm. Supervillain group therapy, yes!
Yeah.
After I read that, there was no way this game could not be on my list.
Yeah.
Yes, and the fact that it really gets at the psychological, neurotic motivations of supervillains, because that is really what makes them so compelling.
Exactly.
And it's really, and the comic books figured this out long ago, and that's why every villain has their own personal, you know, fixation, obsession.
Yeah.
And to have them all sitting down in the same room, you know, the Joker sitting across from Lex Luthor talking out their problems, and also jockeying, though, for position, for status, in the group therapy set, within the frame of the group therapy, I think, is pretty awesome. I am going to run to the bathroom while you talk, because this is the least professional podcast on the internet, and I just drank, like, half a gallon of Hawaiian Punch, because we are mom basement dwellers. But I wanted one little thing... is I feel like the actual resolution of the non-group therapy scenes could have been a little bit more clearly laid out than it was. I think that part of the manual could be streamlined. I don't think there's actually anything mechanically wrong with the process itself at all, but I felt like the way it was laid out in the manual was less clear than it could have been. So, Rudy, you're number two, and I will be right
number two. I would actually like to make one quick comment on Within My Clutches real quick. This seemed to me like the perfect thing for the Watchmen RPG.
Yeah.
Enough said.
Exactly.
I think everybody gets what I'm trying to say there. Now you can go to your number two.
Okay, number two, Queen of Thorns. I know you already mentioned this one, Mike. But I like the fudge dice mechanics. And one thing that I really, really like about this game is that it does something that I and my games have personally tried to do, which is, I don't know how to describe it. I guess non-fixed consequences.
Yes.
Consequences without, you know, basically damage without hit points.
Variable consequences.
Variable.
Is
variable.
What you're trying to say.
Exactly. Yeah. Variable consequences. And I think the way he did that with the fudge dice was really elegant.
Also, strategy goes further, if I may say so, just to further build upon what you were saying. Because if you don't damage it in your success pool, you get consequences anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So,
and you can also use your successes to defend yourself from bad shit, which is pretty cool.
You have multiple things to keep track of in this game, and not keeping track of all of them could be potentially dangerous for your group. So.
Right.
You need a lot of luck, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot of luck, but it's also a lot of strategery.
Yes, it is.
Because it's like, you can measure your roles a lot better than you can in a lot of other games. Because it's such a simple kind of system. And the consequences that are given, I'm trying to think what they were. Like a special effect. Like an added effect, and you take damage, you take a wound.
Yeah. There was other stuff.
The Doom track or the alarm track goes up, yeah.
There was ways to slow down, and there's consequences for the non-player side, too, I believe, too.
Right.
Which were pretty nasty, because you could confuse them.
You could confuse the Queen's minions and stuff like that. And that's another thing that I really liked, was the way this did the GM budget. Because I think that the alarm track is such a brilliant way, and most games that I see that use GM budgets, I think it's kind of hairy. It's like, why is it there? Like, why? What's the explanation for the budget? But with the alarm track, it's really easy to see, because it's like, well, you've alerted her more, so she's going to throw more of her forces at you, or she's going to have stronger power because you've alerted her.
Yes. And there's explanations for how you can get out of that through your successes.
Yeah. So you really have to, you're really caught between spending successes to, you know, reap in the scene, or, you know, get out of the alarm track.
Right.
Or avoid raising it so that you might not get raped later in the scene. But the Doom track, I think, was pretty good too, because it basically was a way of pacing the game. But it didn't feel like it was tacked on to... It didn't feel like it was too arbitrary. It didn't feel like the GM was just arbitrarily assigned, okay, now, you know, you're this close, and, you know, your matron's going to die if you, you know, don't do this. It felt like a really stable and really just visible way to pace the game, so... I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so.
Mr. Mike.
My number two, correct?
Yes.
Shackled Self was my number two. First, the game that has the possibility of getting people laid is totally like, how did you think of this? That's genius. The RPG games are not known for this, right?
No, they're known for the opposite.
Correct. But there's also this tension between each of the characters, because one has to judge the person that they're standing behind.
Right.
The other has to be there to distract the prince, and the prince himself has to keep his path, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
And it really creates this tension between the three while they're all trying to do their own thing.
Right. There's so many different layers of in-character tension going on. Excuse me, both in and out of character.
Right.
Emotional tension going on in this game. It's just fascinating and awesome.
And the differentiation between the past and present scenes, I guess you should say, since there were two types of past scenes.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then you had the night scene, and I forgot the other one off the top of my head.
Wasn't it trial scene or
yes.
test scene?
Yeah, test scene. That's what it was. And that was just so brilliant between them, because you have each one differentiates itself so greatly that it's just perfect.
Right, and differentiates itself by making simple, almost subtle adjustments to the way each role is played and the level of influence that each of the three individual roles has in the scene. There's so much going on in this game.
Yes, absolutely. And the board, of course, was just massively great between the outer ring and all the spaces circling around
Yeah, it was a nice board.
Yes.
The board is another thing that works on so many different levels. First of all, it works on the obvious spiritual level of mirroring that Buddhist concept of, you know, each life bringing you closer to this moment of to being this being of perfection, just self-realization, to becoming, you know, something larger than yourself, or rejoining, you know, becoming integrated with reality, however you want to put it. And the way that the board mimicked that was very cool, while still being very functional as a game board.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's all.
Oh, okay, my number two game, Cam Horus.
Who's Cam Horus?
Where do you begin?
Yeah.
First of all, obviously this is a game that kind of kicks you in the face right at the start.
Yeah.
You see the title and you say, wait, what?
Yeah.
And then you read it and you see it actually delivers on its premise.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, this is far and away the best use of terms in this set of Ronnie Award
entries. Yeah, it was.
The fact that she... Well, she did go with the obvious meaning of lust.
Mm.
But she found a link between lust and Amazon
that
no one else picked
that
up.
Was...
But that is intuitive and brilliant and is a real connection. It's not a tenuous, fabricated connection. It ties to real pathological social behavior that's right. going on everywhere. So just the ingenuity, the creativeness of the concept won it points. But most importantly, since we are talking about RPGs here, the best thing about this game is how well the mechanics match the concept. And it's subtle, and you don't see it immediately because she doesn't go out of her way to spell it out. But that rhythm of flipping one card as, you know,
right.
of each you and your mark laying one card as you're basic, as the mark is basically asking her to put out in one specific
exactly.
way, it really mimics that tit-for-tat, you do this, I do that rhythm. Of the conversation. And I think it should serve to pace the game, pace the interactions and dialogue in the game in a very interesting way. Mm. And remember, this is a game that is basically played as a series of one-on-one dialogue.
Right.
Yes.
So you really need a pacing device that's going to keep those dialogues from meandering and keep pulling it back to the point of the game, which is that you know, the mark wants her to debase herself,
right.
and she wants to pull back, but she still wants the thing off her Amazon wish list.
Exactly.
And that tenuous bargaining, what, as I said before, tit-for-tat relationship, is mimicked so well by the act of laying a card and then watching him lay his card. And
you do this,
card,
I do that.
That. Back and forth.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. Like the fact that this is both the most and least erotic game
yeah,
in the contest.
Yeah.
Because as I said earlier, I couldn't see anyone walking out of this game and then being like, yeah, I'm going to go webcamming tonight.
Yeah.
And you're going to leave this a little sad, a little demoralized.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little... Very sad if you've ever been camming.
Yeah, exactly.
Because... Really? Shouldn't you have already known this?
Yeah, that. That's one thing.
Because, you hit the nail right on the head, though. I mean, it explores just how far are you willing to go to get that shit you want.
Right, right.
Whatever it may be.
On a totally unrelated note, if you're willing to buy me a 3DS, hey!
Dick's coming out tonight.
You like extremely pasty white skin and tiny childlike build? Are you perhaps a pedophile?
Are you perhaps?
No, but honestly, moving on. I thought this was just a really fascinating game. And also, I don't want to I don't want to give the impression that this is some depressing, heavy-handed game, because it's actually a really funny design, too, a really clever, humorous design. The thing I loved was even the picture she chose for the cover art
exactly
sums it up so perfectly.
Yeah.
Because that should be a very erotic picture, but it's really just a very depressing, ugly... Really, depressing is the word for it. You look at that picture and you say, oh my god, I feel so bad for her.
Or texture work.
Yeah. Which is something it must have been, I'm imagining too much here, but I'd hate to have to be Elizabeth and just be scrolling through pages and pages of webcam pictures to find the one that was the right level of sexual while still being the right level of depressing.
Yeah.
Let's just hope that's not her. I'll put it that way.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Just maybe Ben Lehman passed that picture on to her. Okay.
That's a better possibility. Isn't it
me? You're number one.
Cam Horace.
Okay.
More talk about Cam
Horace. I will
say
something about that picture. I think she could have chosen a better picture, and I've seen it. It's the one that has the girl dancing on the camera while her three-month-old is in the background.
Yeah, I have seen that one, too.
And that, I think, would have been perfect. But I fucking love this game. This game, basically, simple mechanics. Mm-hmm. They're easy to get into. And the mechanics really reflect life. I don't know what I can say about it. They reflect life. And the way they let you escalate the conversation, the way many webcam dancers might.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never danced on webcam. I have actually known one person who was a webcam dancer. And that brings me to one point.
Yes, that's a point that I wanted to make.
Too. Yeah, earlier. And that... The first line of this game says, you are female, which, I don't know if that's necessarily, I mean, maybe we should allow for male cam dancers, too, maybe a hack of this game,
yes.
Or additional rule supplement could allow for male cam
I will
dancers.
Say this, the biggest cam whore I have ever known was very male.
Yeah, he was male, and he actually showed me his dick.
Oh! So what do you have to buy him for that, Rudy?
I didn't have to buy him anything, but yeah, he actually showed me his dick on camera.
So. Well, he was pretty enthusiastic about doing it without
he was an exhibitionist.
Provocation.
This has to be known then, gay or straight.
He was gay.
Okay.
Maybe bi, actually.
Maybe bi.
I mean, it doesn't matter if you're gay or straight to be known, because I've known some straight male man whore cam fuckers.
There are no shortages.
That question was pertinent to the situation.
Well, and it's
for
also pertinent to the game, actually, because I don't think it's necessary for it to be a female cam whore and a male mark.
Right.
Also, you could have a male cam whore and a female mark, a male cam whore and a male mark, a female cam whore and a female mark.
Yeah.
Right.
Easily.
So true. Anything is possible. Or transsexual, if you may go there.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, you'd still be male, female. Then you'd be male to female with female, female to male with male, and so on.
Headache! But we all get the idea.
Then you get interesting situations where you're dancing on cam and the junk comes out, and it's like, oh.
Oh, surprise!
Surprise!
Uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable stuff.
Or maybe not uncomfortable. I mean, sometimes it's framed with the expectation that that's what's happening.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, I love this game. And I love, I love Amazon.com being...
Yes.
Being put in here, because that was just so perfect. Perfect use of the term.
Yes.
Absolutely excellent.
And she wasn't the only one to use Amazon.com. I mean, Dan Maruschak did also. But I feel like her use of it was more
it was
spot
stronger.
On than his.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was going to be my transition from his to my number
okay.
one.
What's your number one?
Brick and mortar.
Ah!
See? Hence transition.
There you go.
Brick and mortar, what can I say that hasn't already been said? Important items. Yeah. That was an interesting way to do it because of how it was handled.
Yes, that's something that wasn't mentioned.
Yes, because you had an in-stock, correct? You had some players holding stuff. The regular could hold stuff.
You had things that were in stock and available. You had things that were on the cloud, meaning they might be in the store somewhere, but he doesn't remember where the hell they are. And then you had things that had to be ordered.
Right. And how that tied in with the players who had to make plans.
Yes.
Right.
And you had to complete parts of the plan and then see if the plan could succeed, which let people get away. Sometimes you would help people, sometimes you wouldn't. But it wouldn't necessarily be your win condition.
Right. And you have these plans that are dependent on things that may or may not happen.
Right.
And which is... once again, so much like the source material, where everyone comes up with their plan, you know, they're going to put the corpse in the shopping cart, and they're going to push it down the stair, and someone's going to hold the door open, someone else is a fire extinguisher, and you know, someone else is going to pull the alarm, and they do it, and the guy goes to pull the alarm, and the power's out, you know, and it doesn't work.
And everyone makes their plan according to their own win condition.
Yes.
Hence, selfishness coming before the group dynamic of getting the fuck out of the dangerous situation.
Yeah. Once again, so much like the movies it's based on.
It's just so much great stuff in there that I had to mention that.
So much indeed.
So,
my number one?
Yep.
The Shackled Cell.
We talked to death about this game, but this game just doing.
I love this game.
This game.
While I was playing it, I was just wanted to. Excuse me. While I was reading it, I just wanted to stop and play it.
Yeah.
I love the social dynamic in this game. I love the way that the social dynamic in this game builds upon existing social dynamics in your group, where you're supposed to pick someone who you're. I mean, it could be someone who you are want to have a relationship with or who you're lusting after or whatever. But it could just be someone in the group who you're fascinated with.
Right.
And then you have them play Temptation.
Right.
And it ends on this really awesome sequence where Temptation sits down and you have to literally look Temptation in the eye.
Right.
Have physical contact with Temptation.
Right.
And not bend to Temptation's will.
Right.
Having already established that Temptation is being played by someone who maybe you have a crush on, or maybe is simply a person who, if you're fascinated by someone, it's usually someone who maybe has a stronger personality than you, who's more dominant, or whatever. And that really hits home. One thing I wasn't sure about the endgame was its ability to nullify the win condition. Where everything in the game could be determined by the end game in spite of what had happened earlier in the game. So you can reach the end of the board, and if the mountain decides, okay, now it's time to go into the end game, the final confrontation between Temptation and the Prince, then that final Temptation can go either way, regardless of what's happened earlier in the game. Although, if Temptation wants to make this work in a way that the mountain's going to judge convincing, they have to integrate knowledge they've gained throughout the whole game. So it's not completely iffy. But I was just totally smitten by this game. I love the way, as I said before, the board mechanics blend so perfectly with the dynamics of play. I love the four different types of scenes. I think they're just right. I love the fact that you have past scenes, which are just basically things that happen. But you also have flashback scenes, which are specifically traumatic things that happen. And I like the fact that distinction exists, because it's not one you see often in role-playing games.
Right.
And the night scenes are fantastic, because now not only are you working with things that really happen, but you're working with outright hallucinations and phantasms. And then you have the trial scenes, where the mountain simply takes you and sits you down and presents a clear dilemma for you. Yeah. And the social dynamic, as had come up before, is just perfect. Once again, thinking even to give different players different types of food based on the roles they're playing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Pretty genius. It's almost a combination of those deep form techniques
But molded into a much more robust mechanical framework than usually exists in Jeep form. And one final thing on this game, this was also, I think, the best written game by four.
It was.
The manual was very clear. It moved intuitively from point A to point B to point B, to point C in a way that was chronological whenever possible, and which never presumed that you knew things that it was going to tell you later, which is the biggest failing, I think, of RPG manuals.
Yeah.
I think that if one thing trips up RPG manual design, it's the tendency to tell you something before they tell you something, so that you don't understand what they just told you until you get to the thing they're going to tell you later. Yeah. And this doesn't do any of that. It's a very clean, sleek layout, very simple, but concise, well-chosen language that is also very evocative. So great on all fronts. Yeah. Would love to play this game.
Two details real quick on this.
We're about to... Well, if it doesn't turn over at exactly 1:30, we should be good. If it does turn over at exactly 1:30...
1:33, I think.
1:33?
Yep.
Okay, we're at 1:29 right now.
Okay.
Any final... Very quick final thoughts.
Okay, two details. First, the ending. The mountain makes the decision based on what you did already.
Right.
So, the end game has some consequences on what's already happened.
Right, right.
Secondly, flashback scene... how the temptation can call your bluff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yes. Are you sure what's what really happened? And then temptation makes up something that could have happened.
Which is, I'm glad you brought that up. If the prince tries to basically metagame, power game, bullshit, make himself out to be bigger than he should be, temptation can cut him down to size. And I think every game should have mechanics like that for the dude who's the bullshit artist. But it's not mean mechanics. It's not shut up, you're bullshitting me. It's, are you sure that really happened?
Right.
I think that's fantastic.
Right.
Right. So, that was Mom's Basement podcast. Episode 28. Ronnie's Cast Extended Edition.
Extended Edition.
Episode 29, we are finally going to tackle Keystone. And after that, we might take some time off from playtesting games and do some simpler topical podcasts, as we wait for new games to playtest to come in and to give us some time to relax and not spend 6 hours playtesting game and then an hour podcasting. Okay. So, that's it then. Mom's Basement signing off. Woody, don't you mean to say something?
Mom's Basement.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask Callahan to have your babies.
Oh, yeah. Callahan, have my babies, please.
Yeah.